From WBUR in Boston, I'm Karen Given. And this is NPR sports program, Only a Game. Anthony Iani was heading into his final season with the Michigan State basketball team when he was approached by a teammate, future NBA star Draymond Green.
He was just like, you know, why didn't you tell me about your autism? Why didn't you tell me about all this? I said, well, like with everybody else in my life, Draymond, like, I didn't know how you were going to react.
Today on Only a Game, the friendship that developed between a player with autism and one of the most polarizing figures in the NBA. Plus, XFL player Darius Victor was a high school football player living in Maryland when a friend called with news about his brother.
She called me, like, crying, like, Kevin got shot, Kevin got shot. I'm like, what?
Stay with us. This is Only a Game. I'm Karen Given.
Backdoor, send it in. Wow.
In 2010, the Michigan State men's basketball team reached the Final Four for the second straight season. But while that was playing out on national TV, something historic was happening behind the scenes. It involves a guy who's now one of the most polarizing figures in the NBA.
And a technical foul's been handed out to Draymond Green.
And a pioneering college basketball player. Here's Only a Game's Martin Kessler.
Growing up near East Lansing, Michigan, Anthony Iani knew he was different from other kids. Through fifth grade, he had an aide with him in class. In middle school, he'd go to a resource classroom.
So I was like, okay, you know, I have a learning disability. You know, I'm just going to put it that way. And I don't know what it is, but I have a type of learning disability, just plain and simple.
Anthony's differences affected him beyond the classroom. Anthony loved the Michigan State sports teams. His dad worked in the athletic department, but attending games was rough.
Just like the crowd noises and the horns from the scoreboard, you know, was really too much for me early on.
Anthony also had a hard time understanding jokes and sarcasm. He took everything literally.
So, for example, if somebody had told the 5-year-old me that it's raining cats and dogs outside, well, a majority of the population knows that it's pouring down rain. Where the 5-year-old me would have ran out the door, you know, going outside and hoping that a cat or a dog would literally fall into my arms.
Anthony wanted to fit in at school.
I wanted to be the cool guy. I wanted to be the guy that made people laugh.
And Anthony thought the best way to do that was to recreate what he saw on TV.
You're worth 10 grand to me.
Curly was my favorite of the Three Stooges. And so, for example, like, Curly did a sound effect where he goes, nah, nah, nah. And I did that all the time in the hallways. I mean, I did the hand gestures that, you know, the Three Stooges did all the time. And people who weren't my friends who got a glimpse of it in the hallways encouraged me to go on and on and on. And, you know, looking back on it, I wasn't the guy who was making people laugh. I was the guy that people were laughing at.
Bullies targeted Anthony. He says it didn't help that he was bigger and taller than pretty much everyone at school.
When I started off in sixth grade, I was 6 feet tall with a size 13 shoe. And, you know, people call me so many names like the Jolly Green Giant or, you know, the Giant Peach from James and the Giant Peach. I had people call me that one time. And it's like, you know, people kept egging on and on and on and on about it. And it drove me crazy to the point where I was on the floor crying and like just telling people to stop.
After Anthony finished middle school, he learned something that helped this all make a bit more sense.
Going into my freshman year of high school, my parents sat me down in the living room and said, my dad looked at me and said, son, we have to tell you a little story. I said, okay. So they told me the story about my diagnosis.
At 4 years old, Anthony had been diagnosed with pervasive development disorder.
A higher functioning form of autism along the same lines as Asperger's syndrome.
Doctors and experts told Anthony's parents not to expect much from him.
They told my parents that I was barely going to graduate from high school, never go to college, never be an athlete, and eventually one day I was going to end up in a group institution with other individuals like myself.
Anthony says his first reaction was, who would say that about a little kid? But soon he started thinking something else.
Let's go shut people up. Let's go prove these doctors and experts wrong. Let's show them why you are not going to be in a group institution. And so I kind of had this checklist in my head, you know, after my parents sat me down. And the checklist was graduate from high school, get a full ride scholarship somewhere, and then graduate from college. And so, like, nothing else mattered to me in high school but those things. That's why, like, I didn't worry about, you know, having a girlfriend in high school. You know, granted, did I have crushes in high school? Absolutely. But, you know, I was so focused on just proving the world wrong.
As a freshman at Okemos High School near East Lansing, Anthony was 6'6", and he loved basketball. Anthony's parents had both worked for the Ohio University Athletic Department, so when Anthony was a toddler, he'd go to practices and shoot on a lowered hoop. And at games, he learned to watch the clock and cover his ears when the buzzer was about to go off, until he got more and more comfortable. He says he went to every Michigan State home game. By the end of his senior year of high school, Anthony had earned a scholarship to play at Division II Grand Valley State University. Anthony was ticking off that checklist he'd made for himself. After two seasons at Grand Valley State, in 2009, Anthony decided to transfer to the team he'd grown up rooting for, Michigan State. Anthony didn't know of anyone else with autism who had played Division I basketball. He kept his diagnosis mostly a secret. The Michigan State coaches and a teammate knew, but he didn't tell the rest of the players. And why was that, that you didn't want them to know?
I didn't know how they were going to treat me. You know, because in the past, I told people about my diagnosis and what it was. And, you know, a lot of those people who I thought were my friends at the time, they started treating me differently. They started treating me differently like I wasn't a normal person or I didn't know how to act. Like, they treated me like a little kid after that. And so that's why I didn't tell anybody.
But keeping his autism diagnosis a secret in the Michigan State locker room was going to be difficult, especially when you learn more about the personality of the man who is quickly becoming the centerpiece of the Spartans team.
Draymond Green's in his first action.
Draymond Green has never been afraid to speak up.
He was the locker room leader right from his freshman year.
That's Michigan State Associate Head Strength and Conditioning Coach and Director of Sports Science, Mike Vorkopich. He goes by Vork.
I don't even know if people know my first name on this campus.
Anyways, back to Draymond Green.
And when I say right from his freshman year, not right when he got to campus, but as the season progressed, you know, we lost and he kind of piped off in the locker room in a good, positive way, just saying, hey, like, we're right there, you know, like, we're going to get back to this point, but we're going to get to the Final Four next year. And you don't hear freshmen say that. Mm-hmm. It was like he took the reins.
Anthony Iani arrived at Michigan State that next season. In some ways, he and Draymond Green were quite similar. They were both from Michigan, both grew up Michigan State fans, and Anthony says they had that same chip-on-the-shoulder mentality. But in other ways, Anthony and Draymond couldn't be more different. Anthony was walking on to the Michigan State team. Draymond had committed to Kentucky before picking the Spartans. And while Anthony struggled to understand jokes and sarcasm,
Draymond is the king of trash talk.
That's Austin Thornton, who was on those Michigan State teams with Anthony and Draymond. Austin and his teammates weren't safe from Draymond's trash talk.
When he goes into these trash talking moments, like, he just goes from zero to not even 100, but zero to like 10,000.
He was a jokester.
That's Coach Fork again.
You got to have thick skin when you're Draymond's teammate.
Because Anthony's dad worked in the Michigan State Athletic Department, Coach Vork had known Anthony and about Anthony's diagnosis since he was a kid. So Coach Vork asked Anthony to stay after his first workout with the team.
I said, anytime you're not certain of something, I go, just look at me, say something to me, I'll explain it to you. I got no problem with that.
Were there any times where he would take advantage of that offer you gave him?
Oh, yeah. He would come up to me and just ask questions. Hey, I think guys are saying this. And I'm like, oh, they're just joking. You know, they're just messing with you. He's like, okay. Mm-hmm. He just sort of brush it off like no big deal, you know.
Austin Thornton also knew about Anthony's diagnosis. So Austin would try to help out when teammates started teasing Anthony.
I can't tell you how many times he'd be like hitting me on the table like, hey, they're just joking, right? Like, yeah, it's a joke. You can laugh. You can tease. Like, don't get too upset.
And Austin would try to help Anthony jab back.
They're going to poke fun of you for this. Like, hey, maybe make fun of, you know, this guy for that, or maybe make fun of that guy for this. Like, it's okay to do that.
But this sometimes went badly. Anthony says if teammates joked that his high school's basketball program was horrible,
like, I would say, oh, well, you guys are just, you're average. And so they would just give me that weird look like you do know that average is, you know, better than worse, right?
Because of all this, Anthony says it was hard for him during his first 2 years at Michigan State. But there were no major incidents, and Anthony was still able to keep his diagnosis a secret. Then came a summer workout before the 2011-2012 season. As Anthony remembers it, Draymond Green, Michigan State's best player slash team leader slash trash talker, joked that the team had to do an extra set of leg presses. Coach Vork remembers it as Draymond and the rest of the team telling Anthony he had to redo the VO2 max, a brutal aerobic test. Whatever it was, Anthony couldn't tell it was a joke. He thought he had to keep going.
And so the joke was going on and on and on. People kept piling on about it or saying this, saying that. It drove me nuts. And it almost was like when I was bullied and teased in sixth grade. And so it got to the point where I just basically threw a fit at him. And I almost wanted to knock his teeth out, and because I was so upset. And so I walked up to him. I started arguing with him, you know, telling him to quit it, you know, stop. And then he just flat out said out loud to everybody, well, if you can't take a joke, then you shouldn't be on this team. Like, you should just go home.
Coach Vork didn't witness this exchange, but he saw afterward that Anthony was upset.
Draymond was walking by, and I pulled Day-Day's his nickname. I pulled Day-Day, Day-Day, come here. And he comes over, and I said, hey, man. I said, you got to understand one thing. I go, you guys are messing with Anthony. I said, Anthony's nickname is AI. Mm-hmm. I go, AI doesn't get it a lot of times. And Day-Day looks at me, you know, kind of confused. I go, he's autistic.
Draymond Green declined our interview request, but he talked about this moment for the NBA TV show Beyond the Paint.
And that was the day Vork told me about Anthony's autism. He said, he doesn't understand that joke. It's like you're picking on him because he doesn't see the gray area. It's black and white for him.
The next day, Anthony was still upset. Draymond approached him.
When he walked up to me, I said, oh God, what's this conversation going to be about? Like, you know, do I really want to talk to him? And so he was just like, you know, why didn't you, you know, Vork told me all this. Like, why didn't you tell me about your autism? Why didn't you tell me about all this? I said, well, like with everybody else in my life, Draymond, like, I didn't know how you were going to react. You know, I thought you were going to treat me differently like everybody else I knew in my life. And he looked at me just for like a good 10 seconds, not saying anything. And he said to me, well, first of all, kudos to you because look what you've overcome in your life and look where you're at now. He said, second of all, if you would have told me this from day one, none of this would have happened. And so, you know, he's told people and I've told people that that day, that incident, it changed our relationship forever. We became not only better teammates after that, but we became better friends after that.
Anthony says that after that incident, Draymond would check in about whether or not he understood something. And Draymond also wanted to learn more about autism.
He was always asking me different questions about, you know, hey, you know, how did you learn this despite having autism? Or what did you do in these times? And so, and then once he started asking questions, a lot of my other teammates started asking questions. And so they were starting to learn more and more about me.
After that, Anthony didn't have to look to Coach Vork or Austin to figure out if something was a joke. He could ask the rest of his team. Now Anthony calls that incident with Draymond a blessing in disguise.
Having somebody with that type of stardom, if you will, to understand what one of their teammates is going through and how they can adapt to that person, that really showed me not only what kind of a leader that Draymond was and still is, but what kind of a person he is as well.
In their final season at Michigan State, Anthony Iani scored a total of 3 points and collected 7 rebounds. Draymond Green was the Big Ten Player of the Year. After the Big Ten tournament, Draymond had this to say about Anthony when he spoke to Hondo Carpenter from Spartan Nation. He said, quote, Anthony Iani is the most underrated person on our team. When I am down, when I'm not playing well, he always comes up and tells me how proud he is of me, how much he believes in me. He will always have a special place in my heart. Draymond Green is now a 3-time NBA All-Star with the Golden State Warriors. Anthony Iani completed that checklist. He graduated high school, he got a scholarship, he graduated from college. Now he's married with 2 kids. And a few years ago, he found a new goal. Become a role model for kids with autism. And become a great leader, just like his former teammate, Draymond Green.
That's Only a Game's Martin Kessler. Anthony Iani now travels the country sharing his story of living with autism. And he's got an anti-bullying initiative called the Relentless Tour. We'll have a link at onlyagame.org.
Astrology is as old as civilization itself. And today, it's easier to access than ever before thanks to the internet and smartphones.
This week on Throughline, how astrology almost went extinct and made a remarkable comeback.
Throughline from NPR, the podcast where we go back in time
to understand the present.
I'm Karen Given, and it's time for three stories you should know.
The point is, Aaron Gordon won the contest, had the most memorable dunks. Everyone knows it. He got robbed.
What would the NBA dunk contest be without a scoring controversy? That's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by Toronto-based sports writer Shireen Ahmed via Skype and by Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, Shireen, tell us, was Aaron Gordon robbed?
With all due respect to Derek Jones Jr., the thing is, two finalists in the slam dunk competition, All-Star Weekend in Chicago, really great group of judges, Common, Dwayne Wade, Candace Parker, Scottie Pippen, who definitely needs a stylist, and Chadwick Boseman. Aaron Gordon gets up and performs these flawless dunks, which, you know, we're expecting him to get 10s. He gets a 9. We're all like, what? Derek Jones Jr. gets up there, gets some 10s, more 10s than I think he deserved. And this is me asserting the blame on Dwayne Wade. I have absolutely zero proof it was only Dwayne Wade, although all the fingers seem to point there, because Derek Jones Jr. and Dwayne Wade were teammates on Miami Heat. And I love Dwayne Wade. He has so much style. He's flawless as a parent. But I'm mad. Did those dunks by Aaron Gordon really deserve a 9? No. Like, was I watching the same screen? He jumped over Taco. He jumped over a 20-foot man. So I'm just going to go there and say, when you jump over another human who's that tall and you make that basket in splendid fashion, you deserve all the things. He didn't get the things. We've had a very difficult 2020. This was not helping.
Mike, what do you make of all this?
Okay, first of all, he didn't jump over Taco. He hit him in the head pretty clearly. But, you know, if Taco Fall was only 7'2", it would have been more impressive.
Been fine.
But then, yeah. Isn't this all like blaming, one of the participants in the Iowa caucus or, you know, the Waterloo District vote counter as opposed to the process itself? Mm. Don't hate the player. Don't hate the judge. Hate the game. The scoring system of the slam dunk contest, this is the most important contest in sports. I'll give you that. The scoring system is crazy because everyone wants to signal how impressed they were, and just giving out 10s either have a greater range of scores, make a decision that you only have a certain number of 10s to give out. There are a lot of better ways to do it, but Dwayne Wade didn't come up with the best way. I'll give you that.
Mike, I'm with you here. I really think it's the system that's at fault. I mean, there is a hard enough time scoring sports like figure skating and gymnastics. And like in those sports, every element of every routine has been rated, you know, for difficulty before the event even happens. And still in those sports, sometimes it feels really random. And sometimes it feels like the best person didn't win. So I don't know what we expect to happen when we take athletes and celebrities, nothing against athletes and celebrities, but they're not experienced judges, and we ask them to judge something that is highly subjective and highly unpredictable. I mean, that Taco Fall dunk wasn't even planned. I don't know, Shireen. I actually think expecting fairness in this sort of thing might be setting the bar too high.
I think I agree, but like, can I just be mad at Dwayne Wade about this? Can I have this one? Can I just be mad?
You can. You absolutely can. It is 2020. You have the right to be mad about anything. Okay, Mike, I understand that you also want to talk about NBA All-Star Weekend, but you've been thinking about the actual game.
Yes, and so are the people who decided how the game was to be played. They wanted to mix things up because they know the All-Star game is just horribly, horribly boring. So there's this scoring structure called the Elam ending. Well, they trotted out this idea, and let's just say that a lot of the people paid to analyze sports for a living weren't that pleased. Here's WFAN's Mike Francesa.
The fourth quarter will be untimed. Are we playing forever? Instead, a target score will be set by adding 24 points to the total of whichever team has the lead through three quarters. I mean, come on, this is just downright silly.
And guess what? The players were so into it. And a charge. Kyle Lowry took a charge. This is unheard of in an All-Star game. He ran the length of the court. Spike Lee ran the length of the court as well. It was so unbelievably exciting. I'm so glad that, like a technocrat, Adam Silver said, we're going with this ending. We're trying this. And I want to see this in a lot more regular season games.
Okay, I'm going to respectfully disagree. I failed stats first year. Math is not my forte. And I was sitting there going, what's happening? And the game was amazing. The fourth quarter was amazing. But I don't know if they were motivated necessarily by this new format. For people that have never seen this before, namely myself, I'm like, what is happening? It was bizarre. And isn't boring part of the game?
No.
I'm a soccer player. 90 minutes, some of that game is ugly and boring, but that's the sport. Do we have to be constantly entertained here? And I really get down to it. I just don't want to add any numbers. That's really what it could be. I just don't.
I also am not a fan of math, but I am a fan of entertainment. And I know that change is hard, but I love that you wanted to talk about this, Mike, because it gave me a chance to go back and listen again to Martin Kessler's story about the Elam ending. He did it back in May of 2017. And for those doing math, I know math is hard. That was like 3 years ago. This has been out there for a while. And here's something Nick Elam said back then.
To be honest, my highest hope for this idea is that it is adopted at every level of play and that it will be remembered where one day I'm being inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Mike, that sounded downright crazy 3 years ago. But yeah. Now the NBA says that they will discuss using the Elam ending in the G League and in future All-Star games. Mm. We can all learn to do the math, I think. Did last weekend's game put Nick Elam's future Hall of Fame induction into the realm of possibility?
I think so. I mean, right with the guy who invented the fake yellow line for first down. Different halls of fame. But to address your point, this was a failure of the announcing crew to even try to explain it. Mm. Maybe they thought, oh, we'll just see how it played out. But I think it's incontrovertible. And the participants of the game said it, and almost every commentator said it, that the excitement at the end of the game was a direct outgrowth to the Elam ending.
All right, so by now everyone has probably seen at least one replay of the horrific crash during the final few seconds of Monday's Daytona 500. Ryan Newman is okay. He was released from the hospital on Wednesday, and that has a lot of people talking about an eerily similar crash, the one that killed Dale Earnhardt 19 years ago. Some are saying Dale Earnhardt's death saved Ryan Newman's life, and they're not totally wrong. Six-point safety harnesses, head and neck restraint systems, containment seats, energy-absorbing foam, tougher crumple zones, and even softer walls around the tracks. All of these things have helped to make the sport safer. But I've been thinking a lot this week about how technology can sometimes give people a false sense of security. And I'm thinking here specifically about football, where there's been a huge push to build a better helmet, but of course no helmet has been shown to reduce concussions. That is not what helmets do. So while I'm glad that the technology worked for Ryan Newman, I worry about this tendency to believe that technology can solve everything.
Yeah, no, your point about the helmets is a good one. I interviewed Michael Waltrip, who won the race, and Waltrip himself says that the safety constraints have absolutely saved lives ever since then. When we're talking about saving lives and we're talking about something that's been demonstrated to work, I think it's one thing. But when we talk about helmets, there is always the push and pull. And the better the helmets are, the more likely the wearer of the helmets will engage in dangerous behavior. I mean, shoulder pads themselves save the shoulders, but hurt the head. There is no magic cure for head trauma in football. I think it's unwise to think there is. If anyone holds that as the false hope that football will be, you know, as safe as cross-country running, they're going to be mistaken.
Shireen?
Ryan Newman's recovery and seeing the photo of him walking out of the medical center was staggering. Like, I didn't think he had survived that at all when I saw it. But I agree. Like, if there's ways to make something safer, I think it's definitely worth the while to invest into that. However, let's be very clear that there will be an element of danger. There is. And it would be disingenuous for us to pretend like that's not a reality. As long as we don't rely false hope on things, I get it. But then we still engage in it. That's our choice.
Absolutely. My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been Shireen Ahmed, co-host of the Burn It All Down podcast via Skype, and Mike Pesca, host of the Daily Slate podcast, The Gist. Thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Darius Victor is a running back for the XFL's New York Guardians. He's listed at 5'6" and 226 pounds. Darius isn't the biggest guy out there, but he's got speed and strength. When he was in college, his coach sometimes had to pull him out of practice drills because he would hit too hard. He was hurting his teammates. But there's a reason Darius plays the game of football with so much toughness and intensity. Only a Game's Jonathan Chang has the story.
Darius Victor was born in a refugee camp in Ivory Coast during the Liberian Civil War.
I don't know if you guys ever seen like a Blood Diamond or some type of movie like that. That was the type of environment that I was born in.
When he was five, Darius and his family moved to Hyattsville, Maryland. He doesn't remember much about his childhood in Ivory Coast. But as he got older, he watched documentaries and talked to his parents to learn more about where he grew up.
I remember stories of my parents saying they used to have to hide in bushes, sleep in bushes, things like that to find refuge from the soldiers. So just hearing them say things like that, you know, ducking from bullets, just running for their lives, things like that is just like eye-opening because I see them now and I'm like, wow, you guys really went through that. I went through that, you know, I don't remember it, but just having that background is crazy.
Moving to the U.S. didn't mean that things were going to be easy. Darius says his parents had to work all the time to provide for their seven children. And that's how football came into play.
I started playing football because my older brother, Kevin, and Kevin was 4 years older than me. He was pretty much my designated babysitter, whether he wanted it or not. But he used to go to football practice, and he was pretty good. Like he was, I'm talking about one of the best. And me and him was so competitive. If he liked blue, I was going to say I liked red. It was just like opposite. So I always wanted to be better than him, beat him in everything that we did. So one day, one of his coaches asked me, hey, Little Vic. They used to call me him Big Vic, and I was Little Vic. Hey, Little Vic, you want to play football? And I was like, yeah.
Kevin became Darius's mentor.
I call it tough love. Like when I ran like a long run or something like that, and the flag was called, I used to be one of those kids like wanted to cry, didn't want to play no more, like, Kevin would be the first one, like, what are you crying for? Like, toughen up, you know what I'm saying? It was just like his toughness really made me who I am today. Even when I run the football, like, I think about him saying, why you let him tackle you? Or why didn't you score? Or, like, you know, he would always ask me questions like that, like, to push me to be better.
As a sophomore at Northwestern High School, Darius became an all-county player. He was even better the next season and was named to the All-Metro team. Then it happened.
It was 2011. I was at my friend's Javante house. I first got a call from his girlfriend. She called me, like, crying, like, Kevin got shot. Kevin got shot. And I'm like, what? So I hung up the phone, and it didn't hit me. I'm like, wow, is it really happening? But then my dad called me, like, 2 minutes after. And he was saying it, and he's, like, crying, and I was like, and that's when I lost it. I was like, oh, my God, like, you know.
According to news reports, Kevin was leaving a local rec center when two robbers confronted him and his friends. Kevin was taken to a local hospital where he was pronounced dead. No suspects were ever publicly identified. Darius's family had escaped the violence in war-torn Liberia, only to find it in the U.S.
It was very tough. And what the crazy part is, he was literally like about 100 yards away from the front door to our house.
As time passed, Darius decided he'd honor his brother the best way he could.
Know how he wanted me to carry myself, how he wanted me to just be the best I could be, you know, and just to make him proud now. Now that he's gone, like, I definitely have to step up to the plate.
In his senior year, Darius became an all-state running back for his high school. At Towson University, he was all-conference. Darius wasn't selected in the 2017 NFL draft, but he got an offer to join the New Orleans Saints rookie minicamp. But the Saints cut Darius before the season began. He joined the Arizona Cardinals, and they cut him too. An opportunity in the Canadian Football League didn't work out either. Still, Darius just kept pushing himself.
Having a 9-to-5 and then working out after, not even just a regular workout, but training like a professional athlete, you know, and then just waking up doing it all over again. So it was very stressful.
Then the XFL happened.
Vince McMahon, who's the chairman of WWE, he announced today officially that he's bringing the XFL back. He went back and got his old trademarks. He's investing.
Darius received an invitation to the showcase in St. Louis, where players got a chance to show off their skills. Darius says he felt good about how it went, and soon his name was added to the list of players available in the XFL draft. And in the 9th round, it happened.
Guardians select Darius Victor, running back, Towson.
I never got drafted before. You know, every kid's dream is to get drafted. So having that moment is amazing.
Through the first two games of the season, Darius Victor rushed for 48 yards in 12 attempts.
I'm blessed with the opportunity, so I have to go hard. And you never know when your last play is going to be. So that's how I take it every day, every play. And I know Kevin would be proud of me in the way I play.
That story came from Only a Game's Jonathan Chang. During a visit to Cooperstown, a lobbyist from Long Island started thinking.
And I said to myself, oh my God, what an amazing idea it would be to have presidents and world leaders sign baseballs and start a collection and share it with the world.
That's coming up. And remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This from NPR. And on our latest episode, how Julia Hartz and her husband Kevin launched their ticketing platform, Eventbrite, from a closet in a San Francisco warehouse, and today manage events in 170 countries around the world. Listen now.
I'm Karen Given. Next week on Only a Game, the bureaucratic way the University of Texas kept its football team all white until 1970. But first, Charlie Pierce is here with the week's news. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Karen.
Rob Manfred is having a, let's call it a challenging year as the commissioner of baseball. Which of his recent missteps do you find the most egregious? Choosing not to punish the players involved in the sign-stealing scandal or calling the World Series trophy, quote, just a piece of metal?
Well, first of all, Rob Manfred is terrible at being a baseball commissioner.
Yeah.
As have been every baseball commissioner of my lifetime. It is a job designed to be held by a person who is not very good at that job. That's the way the owners want it. That's the way it works. The sainted late Bart Giamatti was in the middle of the collusion scandal. Petey Ueberroth ran the collusion scandal. Bud Selig, you know, was perfectly happy to have juiced up players save baseball from his own bungling of the cancellation of the World Series. I mean, find me a competent commissioner of baseball and I'll buy him a drink, even if he's dead. If you buy into baseball's latest moral hysteria, which is the sign-stealing scandal, that's worse than bad-mouthing the trophy because, quite frankly, the trophy's ugly as hell. The trophy looks like a collection of swizzle sticks.
Meanwhile, Manfred is reminding pitchers that it is very, very dangerous to intentionally plunk batters. This is an attempt to stop pitchers from taking their own retribution against members of the 2017 Astros. Think anyone will listen?
I think this is not going to fall on Rob Manfred. It's going to fall on the umpires. Mm. They're going to have to decide whether or not something is retaliatory or not, which is pretty much what they do anyway. But it'll have a special edge this year because every time a ball gets within 20 feet of an Astros batter in Houston, the crowd's going to go wild. It's a good warning, but let's face it, you shouldn't throw a baseball 100 miles an hour at anybody for any reason.
Right.
A well-conditioned major league pitcher can kill you.
Little leagues across the country are dropping the Astros nickname because they say it sets a bad example for the children. Do you agree?
I'd refuse to be outraged, just as I refuse to be outraged about steroids. And I think this moral posturing of dropping the Astros nickname, what, you want us to, like, forget about John Glenn, too? I mean, that's where the nickname comes from. We're going to banish John Glenn because he's associated with the Astros who stole signs? Please, stop taking yourself so seriously, baseball. And please, God, let the game start, because then we'll have something else to talk about.
The U.S. women's national soccer team has filed for summary judgment and asked for $67 million in damages and back pay in their lawsuit against the U.S. Soccer Federation. Meanwhile, the federation has asked the judge to dismiss the case outright. This all feels like legal posturing to me. I mean, this one's going to trial, right?
You're right. It is going to trial. There's an initial offer, an initial counteroffer. Nobody expects one side to accept either initial offer or counteroffer. So, yeah, we're going to be – this one's going to court. But you got to love them. They're not aiming small.
No. I mean – The NCAA is working on a proposal that would allow college athletes to transfer schools once without having to sit out, but only if their original school grants them a release. Gee, how charitable of them.
Yeah, I mean, basically what they're doing is they're taking away the one-year penalty.
Mm-hmm.
But they're leaving in place – the university's ability to deny a player his right to, like, move on, for example, if the coach at his school takes a multi-million-dollar job to coach elsewhere.
Yeah.
So this is an improvement in which nothing really gets better.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, is something the NCAA excels at.
They're really good at it.
They're good at that, yeah.
I mean, it feels to me that the NCAA is at a real crisis point here. Change the rules or risk being legislated out of existence. It doesn't feel like this is the kind of change that is going to keep the hounds at bay.
No, it's not. And by the way, they've been at this particular crisis point for about 25 years now. I mean,
fair.
Various government bodies, various legislatures, national and state, have been threatening to bring the hammer down on the NCAA forever. Ever since the O'Bannon trial, we are at a critical mass in which actual reform has to happen before the whole system just falls down around them.
And finally, Charlie, is there anything more 2020 than the tattoo recently inked on the arm of a Chiefs fan?
Yeah, he got himself a tattoo featuring Andy Reid as the Mandalorian without his helmet, so you know it's Andy Reid. And an actually kind of creepy Patrick Mahomes as Baby Yoda, in which Patrick Mahomes as Baby Yoda sort of looks like an evil elf that would bite your face. I think he needs to get his money back on the on Patrick Mahomes' Baby Yoda.
I mean, Patrick Mahomes, nice-looking fella. Baby Yoda, totally cute. Together, not so much.
Doesn't work that way, no.
Charlie Pierce is the guest editor of the Best American Sports Writing 2019, and he joins us each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Karen.
On March 19th, 2013, as a rainy day turned to dusk, tens of thousands of people huddled together under multicolored umbrellas on St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. Then, just after 7 p.m., white smoke appeared through the chimney of the Sistine Chapel. Lino Rulli and Father Dave Dwyer had the call from the Vatican for the Catholic Channel.
You can actually see that the curtain is about to be pulled back. The window is about to be opened. And let's take a listen to the name of the next pope.
4,000 miles away, Randy Kaplan, a Jew from Long Island, was in his office in New York. He's a lobbyist, watching CNN with his boss and a good friend. Randy's always paying attention when a new head of state is announced.
To me, that's my Kentucky Derby, or that's my Super Bowl. Absolutely.
For 20 years, Randy has been trying to do something that sounds pretty simple. He wants to get a baseball signed by the Pope. And for 20 years, he failed.
Very, very hard to infiltrate that inner circle. I tried every mechanism which I know, and I don't take no for an answer, so it's very difficult for me to come to terms with it's not going to happen.
But this time, Randy wasn't taking any chances. Knowing that he was unlikely to get a sitting pope to sign a baseball, he instead started requesting signed balls from the cardinals most likely to become the next pope, and...
Before the smoke was rising from the chimney at the Vatican, I probably had about 20 of the cardinals out of about 25 or 30 who had a realistic chance.
Cardinal Bergoglio
I believe it's fair to say the world is stunned.
This is a stunner. This is a stunner.
Randy Kaplan had sent Cardinal Bergoglio, now named Pope Francis, a baseball to be signed. It had been returned to sender. So Randy still didn't have a baseball signed by the Pope, but he wasn't about to give up. With help from a friend who happened to be a cardinal, he sent a couple more baseballs to the Pope's personal secretary, but he wasn't optimistic.
Getting the actual Pope to sign as Pope, that's hitting the jackpot for autograph collectors.
Randy Kaplan's not just any autograph collector. His quest is to collect baseballs signed by all of the heads of state and world leaders. Growing up in the 70s, Randy collected the kinds of things kids were collecting back then. Wacky package stickers, baseball cards.
Aurora Monster model kits, the glow-in-the-dark kits.
When Randy was in high school, he snuck backstage at rock concerts, hoping to catch a glimpse of one of his idols. And because he was close to Manhattan, Randy met lots and lots of famous people.
I asked for a couple of autographs here and there throughout, but nothing crazy.
In April of 1993, things started to get decidedly crazier. Randy was on a business trip to Houston, and he decided to go to an Astros game. The woman sitting next to him mentioned that former President George Herbert Walker Bush and his wife Barbara came to games whenever they were in town.
He was just out of office a couple of months, and I've always been a huge admirer of his. And I did not think that they would be coming on that particular night because there was a failed assassination attempt on the former president just a couple of days prior in Kuwait. But lo and behold, sure enough, after the second inning begins, here comes George and Barbara Bush, and they sit down literally a row in front of me. So I'm like, this is amazing. Because as a kid in my teens and in my 20s, I had met everybody you could imagine, the rock stars, as I mentioned, the sports stars. I was never moved so much as when I met a president. I had him sign my scorecard, and I remember bouncing off the walls.
A couple of weeks later, Randy was visiting the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and he saw a collection of baseballs. They had all been first pitches thrown by sitting presidents.
And I said to myself, oh my God, what an amazing idea it would be to have presidents and world leaders sign baseballs and start a collection and share it with the world.
Randy thought about the idea for 3 years. He wasn't quite sure where to begin. Then in 1996, he was working as the government affairs director for a large trade association, and then President Bill Clinton came to give a speech. Randy arrived 3 hours early. Secret Service agents were still doing their sweep. He got a seat near the front. As soon as the talk was over, he hopped into the receiving line.
And I accomplished my goal. I got my baseball signed by Bill Clinton. It was wonderful. It was a great way to start.
Tell me the story of how you got the Gorbachev ball.
Oh, God, this is a wonderful story.
It was 1996, 5 years after the Soviet Union dissolved. Gorbachev had written a memoir and scheduled 2 book tour stops in the United States.
So I knew I had to get to the book signing early. I also knew I needed a trick up my sleeve because security was going to be extremely tight.
Luckily, Randy's landlord was Russian. Randy asked him to write out a Russian phrase, phonetically, on the back of a business card, and he brought the card with him to the book signing.
And I practiced all morning. As I approached the table, Mr. Gorbachev smiled, and as he's signing the book, I pulled the baseball out. Security jumped on my arms to take the baseball away and push me away.
Through all the commotion, Randy kept speaking directly to the former Soviet leader.
It started off something along the lines of Butle Lebezhnev. I don't remember the rest, but I do remember the concept was, Mr. Gorbachev, it's a pleasure to meet you. Would you be kind enough to sign my baseball and take a photograph with me? President Gorbachev stood up, pushed the security guard out of the way, retrieved the baseball from my hand, signed it, stood up and bowed to me and sat down. I was so proud of that.
Randy says getting Gorbachev to sign one of his baseballs so early in his quest really gave him the momentum to keep going. You're not partisan with this at all, are you?
Absolutely not. Republican, Democrat, communist, independent, it doesn't matter. I don't even think about politics when I pursue my collection. My mantra and my motto is diplomacy through baseball.
Dictator or duly elected, if you're a world leader, Randy would like your signature on a baseball. Randy hopes one day his collection will be displayed at the headquarters of the UN, and he wants people who see it to understand that we may have disagreements, but that we're all here on the same planet. And countries that feel like they're on the other side of the world, well, they're really not far away at all.
And this way we can get the world to come together and hopefully be a better place.
We have different ideology, but we share the same biology, Randy said. Then he laughed and admitted that he stole that phrase from a Sting song. But make no mistake, Randy Kaplan cares deeply about who wins major elections in the U.S. and around the world.
The average person walking down the street, they're worried if the Yankees won or the Mets won. They're not worried about who the new French president's going to be.
Randy says he spends 20 to 30 hours a week researching world leaders and prospective world leaders. That's how he got signed baseballs from Presidents Barack Obama and Donald Trump, long before either had announced their candidacy for president. And he never goes anywhere without a bag filled with half a dozen baseballs and some pens. He says you never know who you're going to run into.
I sat next to Henry Kissinger on a plane one day by sheer chance, coming home on the shuttle 20 years ago. My wife and I were having dinner one night. We ran into a couple of foreign leaders, the former president of Benin, Matthew Kerikau, who's now deceased.
Okay, so it's quite possible that I've sat in a restaurant with the former president of an African country I can't even point out on a map. But Randy's not like me. He's researched all the world leaders. There's no country too small or too far flung. But while Randy's familiar with all the world's leaders aren't familiar with America's national pastime. So when Randy handed Matthew Kerikau that baseball,
I had to point to it and show him what to do, where to sign it.
As news of Randy's collection has spread, more and more people have been offering to help. He keeps his collection at a secured storage facility and only gets to see his baseballs when a museum puts them on display. But despite all his successes, Randy was still waiting for his Holy Grail, a baseball signed by the Pope. And then one day in spring of 2017,
the mail comes. I didn't even have to open it. I knew the ball was signed. I had this unbelievable feeling inside. I opened it up. The ball is beautifully signed, Francisco. I am still bouncing off the walls and beaming about this one. To think that, here's how I look at this. The Pope held the baseball in his hand. He knows about my collection. He knows all the other people who've signed it. That's very meaningful to me.
It's probably a stretch to suggest that the Pope signed Randy's baseball because he likes the idea of bringing the world together through baseballs signed by world leaders. Then again, that seems like just the kind of message Pope Francis would support. And besides, Randy Kaplan says, a baseball signed by the Pope is one step closer to having them all.
The Pope, let's face it, one of the toughest and most desirable signatures on the planet. Right up there with the Chinese leader and Vladimir Putin, both of which I would love to have. If anybody's listening and they have a relationship with either Vladimir Putin or the current Chinese leaders, please do get in touch with me.
That story first aired in July of 2017. Since then, Randy Kaplan's collection has continued to grow. He has now collected 449 baseballs signed by world leaders, including one signed by Vladimir Putin. Only a Game is produced by Jonathan Chang, Martin Kessler, and Gary Wallach. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. Our executive producer is me. I'm Karen Given. Only a Game returns next week. Thanks for listening.